incentives to focus on base mobilization. Here, as elsewhere, polarization begets polarization, it's a wheel, not a switch. Strong partisans, weak parties, and broken primaries. The decline of persuadable voters sounds like good news for political parties. How much easier to focus on the swath of the electorate that agrees with them, that already believes what they believe, than the mushy middle. But parties, too, are in decline. The dinning characteristic of our moment is that parties are weak while partisanship is strong, wrote Marquette University political scientist Julia Azari. She's right, and it's one of the most important insights for understanding the rise of Trump, the success of more ideologically extreme candidates, and the American political system's deepening vulnerability to charismatic demagogues. At the beginning of the book, I posed a question: how did a candidate as abnormal as Trump win the Republican primary and end up with such a normal share of the general election vote? Weak parties and strong partisanship is the answer. Trump's win would have been impossible in the strong party system we had FTY years ago. Elites within the Republican Party viewed him with horror. His primary opponents spoke of him in apocalyptic terms. Ted Cruz called Trump a pathological liar, utterly amoral, and a narcissist at a level I don't think this country's ever seen. Rick Perry said Trump's candidacy was a cancer on conservatism, and it must be clearly diagnosed, excised, and discarded. Rand Paul said Trump is a delusional narcissist and an orange-faced windbag. A speck of dirt is way more qualified to be president. Marco Rubio called him dangerous and warned that we should not hand the nuclear codes of the United States to an erratic individual. And then every single one of those Republicans endorsed Trump. Cruz told Americans to vote for the pathological liar. Perry urged people to elect the cancer on conservatism and then later served as its Secretary of Energy. Paul backed the delusional narcissist. Rubio campaigned to hand the nuclear codes of the United States to an erratic individual. The list goes on. Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, endorsed Trump, as did Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and Reince Priebus, the head of the Republican National Committee. Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, commiserated with Dan Senior, a former Bush advisor, over the fact that Trump was unacceptable and then signed on as Trump's vice president. 5. With that kind of elite support, it's little wonder Trump managed to consolidate Republican-leaning voters behind him. Whether you were a Trump Republican or a Cruz Republican or a Ryan Republican or just someone who didn't like Hillary Clinton, the choice was clear: vote Trump. Trump would appoint Republican judges, pass Republican tax cuts, GHT Republican enemies. The decision to endorse Trump was binary, Ryan told CNN. It was either Trump or Clinton, and Ryan knew where he fell. In the balance of things, the good clearly outweighs the things I don't agree with. We don't have people who run for OCE who 100% reset all of our views. It doesn't work like that. 650 years ago, Republican Party elites would have stopped Trump long before the choice collapsed into the binary of him or Clinton. Up until the 1970s, party nominations were controlled by party ochales. The only way to win a presidential nomination was to win the delegates at the national convention. That meant convincing party bosses who cared more for their own power than ideology and who prioritized, above all, being able to work with whoever took OCE. The horse trading to win a nomination could be intense, particularly when no candidate entered with a commanding majority of delegates. In 1924, Democratic delegates went through more than 100 ballots before nominating John W. Davis. It's from brokered conventions like these that we get the modern metaphor of smoke LLED back rooms. Both parties have since turned their presidential nomination processes over to party primaries, which means that the measure of a candidate isn't whether he or she can win over party bosses but whether he or she can win over the intense minority of party supporters who turn out to vote in primaries. In 2016, for instance, less than 30% of eligible voters participated in primaries, and that was unusually high. This has made parties weaker, partisans stronger, and the American political system more vulnerable to demagogues. As Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt argue in How Democracies Die, American politics has long given rise to demagogic showmen with intense bases of support. The anti-Semitic priest and radio star Father Coughlin T.S. this description, as does Henry Ford and Louisiana Governor Huey Long. But even if 20 or 30% of the population loved them, they had no chance at winning a party convention. The convention system was an edict of gatekeeper, in that it systematically aired out dangerous candidates. Party insiders provided what political scientists called peer review. Mayors, senators, and congressional representatives knew the candidates personally. They had worked with them, under diverse conditions, over the years and were thus well positioned to evaluate their character, judgment, and ability to operate under stress. Smoke LLED backrooms therefore served as a screening mechanism, helping to keep out the kind of demagogues and extremists who derailed democracy elsewhere in the world. American party gatekeeping was so effective that outsiders simply couldn't win. As a result, most didn't even try. 7. Today, though, the path to a nomination runs through primaries and caucuses, both of which favor candidates with intense supporters, even if they're not the candidates with the broadest support. After all, you can't win a caucus on a rainy, cold night in January unless you have supporters willing to go out in the wet and spend hours caucusing for you. We've evolved from a system that selected candidates who were broadly appealing to party o'chales to a system that selects candidates who are adored by base voters. Put differently, neither Donald Trump nor Bernie Sanders would have had a prayer in the 1956 presidential primaries, but one of them won and the other nearly won the 2016 presidential primaries. Threaded through that change is a strange fact in American political life. We consider party o'chales exercising influence over party nominating processes as illegitimate. You can see a stark version of this in the battle over Democratic superdelegates. In 2016, about 85% of delegates to the party convention were normal delegates, bound by the results of primaries and caucuses, but about 15% were so-called superdelegates, who could vote however they wanted. These superdelegates were elected o'chales or other high-up party functionaries, and they became a focal point for Sanders supporters, who worried that they'd throw the nomination to Clinton even if Sanders won the most primaries and caucuses. In theory, this was plausible. In New Hampshire, Sanders won the primary by more than 20 points, netting 15 of the state's regular delegates to Clinton's 9. But New Hampshire also had 8 superdelegates, 6 of whom endorsed Clinton before the primary even happened, meaning that Clinton emerged from the primary with a loss in the vote but a tie in delegates. It didn't end up mattering because Clinton won more primary votes and regular delegates nationally than Sanders did, but the existence of the superdelegates enraged Sanders's supporters. It seemed ugly and undemocratic that a bunch of party o'chales could swing the nomination to the runner-up in the primaries. The DNC heeded the outcry and changed the rules in 2018, now only normal delegates can vote on the convention's RST ballot. You might think this an odd change to make in the aftermath of an election where elite weakness on the Republican side led to Trump's nomination. Shouldn't that have proven there is a role for party o'chales to play in blocking unqualified demagogues, even if they are able to win some primaries? But the truth is that even if party o'chales had the power to act as a check on their base's will, they no longer had the popular legitimacy to use it, the resulting backlash would split the party in two. Parties aren't weak because the rules have changed. The rules have changed because parties are weak. What's true at the presidential level is also true at the congressional level. Ideological primary challenges have become more common in recent decades, particularly in the Republican Party. Clark University political scientist Robert Boatwright found that the share of Republican primary challenges that are based around the incumbent not being conservative enough has shot from less than 25% in the 1970s to more than 40% in the 2010s. Among Democrats, ideological primary challenges have gone from a bit under 10% to a bit over 10%. Democratic primary challenges are likelier to focus on social identity than ideology, 0.8 while it remains rare for politicians to lose a primary challenge, it happens often enough, and in high-profile enough cases, that no member of Congress can afford to rest easily. Every Republican realizes he could share the fate of former House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who lost in a shocking upset to conservative challenger Dave Brat. And every Democrat realizes he could end up like former Representative Joe Crowley, widely believed to be a future House Speaker, before Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ended his career. All of this has eroded the power of party elites and amplified the power of primary voters, who are a much more polarized group than general election voters. And it has forced members of Congress, who mostly occupy safe seats, to pursue more polarized political strategies in order to keep themselves secure. Of course, political security is a resource you can at least partially purchase, so long as you can raise the funds. And money is another place where parties are weakening, partisans are strengthening, and polarizing candidates are prospering. Institutional donors are corrupting, small donors are polarizing. On September 9, 2009, President Obama gathered a joint session of Congress for a rare, nationally televised speech about health care. The speech, which came at a moment of peril for the Affordable Care Act, is largely forgotten today. But there is a moment in it that has passed into the political lore and meme of the era. Obama had made the case for his plan and turned to trying to rebut the distortions that had snaked into the national conversation. There are also those who claim that our reform effort will ensure illegal immigrants, he said. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. Sitting in the audience, Congressman Joe Wilson, a South Carolina Republican, couldn't contain himself. You lie, he shouted. Obama wasn't lying. The legislative text barred the undocumented from BEIN ETS. But it was Wilson's breach of decorum, not his more banal abuse of the truth, that stunned even his colleagues. Totally disrespectful, said Senator John McCain, just months out from losing the election to Obama. Republican leadership leaned on Wilson to apologize, which he kind of, sort of, did. I let my emotions get the best of me when listening to the president's remarks regarding the coverage of illegal immigrants in the health care bill, he said in a statement. But if the Republican Party wasn't happy with Wilson's outburst, Republican voters sure were. Within a few weeks, Wilson raised almost $2 million from conservatives thrilled by his comments, and he went, overnight, from House backbencher to GOP celebrity. It wasn't just that Wilson was raising money, it was that other Republicans were begging him to come help them raise money. I've received hundreds of invitations, he said. I've had dozens of members of Congress ask me to appear in their districts. Republic, Michelle Bachmann said, Joe, you're a hero in Minnesota. Nine in becoming a hero to Bachmann's supporters, Wilson had become a villain to Obama's. His opponent in the upcoming 2010 election, Rob Miller, also began fundraising on Wilson's notoriety. He should be doing an apology tour, he said of Wilson, who had embarked on a thank you tour in the incident's aftermath. He should be apologizing to every teacher, every law enforcement official, every man, woman and child in South Carolina for being disrespectful to the president. Miller nationalized that argument and raised $1.5 million in the weeks after Wilson went viral. The game has changed, he said of his haul. The campaign has changed. 10 Wilson and Miller went on to raise and spend more than twice as much as any other House race in South Carolina that year, much of it from out-of-state donors. For all that, Wilson won by about the same margin he posted in 2008. There was an important lesson buried in the Wilson drama, but it had nothing to do with health care. It had to do with money, how the trend toward national networks of highly ideological small donors is changing the way campaigns are funded and the way candidates compete for those funds. In their book Campaign Finance and Political Polarization, When Purists Prevail, Raymond LaRaja and Brian Shauna argue regulations don't keep money out of politics so much as redirect the channels through which money gets into politics. Slap limits on donations to political parties, and people begin giving to candidates. Slap them on candidates, and they give to super PACs. That means you can use the DeRent regulations of DeRent states to learn quite a bit about how DeRent fundraising rules change politics. In particular, you can compare states where the parties raise huge amounts of money that they distribute to candidates with states where the candidates have to fundraise for themselves. So La Raja and Shauna gathered data for all FTY states from 1990 to 2010, looking at how restrictions on giving to parties affected polarization. The lesson was clear: the more powerful the parties were, the less polarization the state legislatures showed. These results were biggest in the states where money mattered most and just plain large overall. Looking at the 36 professional legislatures, that is, the states where being a member of the legislature is a real, paid job, La Raja and Shauna compared the states that limited party contributions between 1997 and 2007 with those that didn't. The increase in polarization was nearly three times as large in the 28 chambers that limited party contributions as it was in the 8 chambers that allowed for unlimited contributions, they write. Point 11. I'm doubtful that campaign finance laws explain the entirety of those results, but it's still a telling ending and relevant to national politics, which sharply curtailed party fundraising with the McCain-Feingold Act. The big picture, as La Raja and Shauna see it, is that parties want to win and are willing to support more moderate candidates to notch those victories. But it may go beyond that. A criticism more ideological activists make of the party committees is that they prize moderation even when it is unlikely to enhance electability, and the data backs them up. Research by Florida State University political scientist Hans Hassel showed that party networks supported more moderate candidates even in safe seats. Point 12. Whatever the motivation, if you're a candidate who wants to fund your campaign in a state where the party controls the money, your incentive is to convince your party that you can win, and that often means convincing it of your ideological and temperamental moderation. But if you have to raise the money yourself, your incentives change. Most people, and most groups, don't give money to politicians. Those who do give are, predictably, more polarized, more partisan, or they want something. You motivate them through inspiration, outrage, or transaction. Put differently, you appeal to them through ideology, identity, or corruption. La Raja and Shauna cut this divide into pragmatists and purists. Politics, they argue, is a war between pragmatists concerned primarily with staying in power and policy-demanding purists, who care above all about getting their agenda passed. Defunding parties empowers the purists over the pragmatists. I think this typology misses the powerful role of political identity and negative partisanship. Here, as elsewhere, political conflict isn't just about policy, and it's not just about power. It's about group conflict. That is different, to be clear, from it being about winning. If it was just about winning, people would give to the closest races, based on expert opinion about ipping seats. But people often give to the races where they're most ideologically invested, no matter the chances of success. Look at the amount of money Democrats spent on the Texas Senate race in 2018, their loathing of Ted Cruz overwhelming the lure of more winnable elections against less hated incumbents. Wilson didn't raise his millions because of a purer policy agenda or because he represents a swing seat. He raised them because conservatives hated Obama, and he became, momentarily, their champion, no matter where they lived. That's another difference between party-centric fundraising and candidate-centric fundraising. Parties know who's running for OCE where. They pay a phalanx of staers to research which districts are vulnerable, which candidates are capable, which races deserve money. But voters don't have a full-time STA picking through candidate resumes 6 days a week. So candidates who want to raise big money from individuals need to somehow get known by those individuals. You can do it by being a generational political talent, like Obama when he ran for Senate in 2004. You can do it by running against someone whom your party really hates, as O'Rourke did in taking on Cruz. You can do it by pulling a controversial stunt that makes you the center of a national restorm, like Wilson did. You can do it by going viral on social media, as Ocasio-Cortez does, or getting yourself regularly interviewed constantly on the news, as Senator Chuck Schumer was famous for in New York. You can do it by renting lists of past party donors and trying to send them fundraising emails or making fundraising calls that get their attention. But somehow or another, you need to stand out. You have to get noticed, retweeted, booked. And, in general, loud gets noticed. Extreme gets noticed. Confrontational gets noticed. Moderate, conciliatory, judicious not so much. Here, political trends are being compounded by technological ones. I was an intern on Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign, which was the RST to use the internet to ND supporters, organize them into a movement, and use them to nance a campaign. I was there, stunned like everyone else, when the big red thermometer tracking individual donations before the third quarter deadline nearly reached $15 million. No one had ever done that before. And they hadn't done it before because they couldn't do it before. Prior to email, this was before the social media revolution, and yes, I do feel old. It was costly for campaigns to communicate with supporters, even if they had them, and difficult for supporters to donate to campaigns, even if they wanted to. Mail is expensive at the scale of millions and too slow to take advantage of a momentary outrage dominating the news cycle. But digital tools are instant, and if not costless, pretty close to it. You can ping backers constantly, track them closely, let them connect to one another in ways that deepen their connection to you. God, we were idealistic about what it all meant. Joe Trippi, Dean's campaign manager, published a memoir/manifesto entitled The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Subtitle, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything, which sounded more hopeful and less sinister at the time. This was nothing less than the RST shot in America's second revolution, Trippi wrote, nothing less than the people taking the RST step to reclaiming a system that had long ago forgotten they existed. 13 small donor democracy was going to save us. It would wring the corruption out of politics, permit new kinds of candidates to run and win, engage voters who'd been ignored in favor of deep-pocketed donors. It was thrilling. It was even partly true. But we didn't see the dark side clearly. Dean, the little-known governor of Vermont, electoried the campaign by being willing to say what too many leading Democrats wouldn't, the Iraq War was a mistake and Bush's presidency was a disaster. He was right. Subsequent candidates would, like Dean, ND that you could raise tremendous amounts of money and excite huge crowds of people by saying the things that millions of Americans wanted said, even if the parties didn't want their leading gurus saying them. There is real value here. But it's a channel through which racist lies and xenophobic demagoguery can travel as easily as overdue truths. The overthrow of everything, indeed. As these tools, rules, trends, and technologies matured, small donor fundraising exploded. Political scientists Karen Sebold and Andrew Doddle looked at small donor donations to presidential campaigns during the all-important year leading up to the primary. This is both the crucial period for campaigns looking to build support and well before the press and most voters turn their attention to presidential politics. Sebold and Doddle found that the total number of small contributions rose from 55,000 in 2000 to more than 566,000 in 2016, a more than tenfold increase. 14 As it's become easier to fund campaigns through individual contributions, more candidates have done it. But that's also changed the kinds of candidates who prosper in primaries. In 2016, Bernie Sanders smashed small donor fundraising records, raising more than $130 million from small donors and far outpacing Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley. On the Republican side, Donald Trump also raked in small donor cash, 15 crushing John McCain's and Mitt Romney's campaign totals months before the election. I don't consider Trump and Sanders morally equivalent politicians, but both represent the weakening hold of political parties. The nationalization of politics is both a cause and consequence of these trends. As Daniel Hopkins shows in his book The Increasingly United States, How and Why American Political Behavior Nationalized, the share of itemized political giving, that is to say, contributions over $200, which have to be reported to the Federal Election Commission that goes to in-state political candidates, has fallen from two-thirds in 1990 to one-third in 2012. That's a sharp drop, but it makes sense. As political media becomes more nationalized and less local, we hear more about national candidates. Hopkins NDS, tellingly, that the share of Americans who can name their governor has been declining, even as the share that can name the vice president has held steady. He also NDS that when asked to name the politician they hate most, only 15% name someone in their own state. And we all know that voter turnout is massively higher in presidential elections than other years, but Hopkins shows that Senate elections, which are framed as part of the national political story, have recently passed gubernatorial elections as a turnout driver, too. We hear more about national candidates, controversies, and conists. Those are the stories we're invested in. Our donations follow our attention. It is worth pausing on this point a moment, because it illuminates one of the fundamental debates in politics and a thread of this book. Under materialist theories of political engagement, where people participate because they're trying to maximize their share of the resources politicians control, this engagement pattern doesn't make sense. State and local political decisions matter more for most people's daily lives than the debates that drive national politics. People have far more power to influence their mayor, state senator, or governor than they have to influence the president. People should be most engaged in the tangible stakes of the politics nearest to their experience, not the more abstract collisions of the national scene. But under an identity model of political engagement, where people participate to express who they are, who they support, and who they loathe, it makes perfect sense. Of course you are likelier to donate to defeat the politician who serves as the villain in the political dramas you watch rather than some local legislator whose name you can't remember. Of course the stakes of national politics, with their titanic clashes over good and evil, their storylines omnipresent on social media and late-night comedy, are more gripping than local bond ordinances. But as we give more to national candidates and less to local candidates, that creates incentives for candidates to nationalize themselves, focusing on the polarizing issues that energize donors in every zip code rather than the local issues that specifically matter in their states and districts. The rewards here, as viral superstars of both parties routinely discover, are massive. You don't become a national guru by being boring. Of course, neither Trump nor Sanders actually raised the most money in the 2016 primary. And that's because small donors and even individual donors aren't the whole picture. There's also the endless hood of cash from access-oriented donors. In an interesting paper, Michael Barber exploits another deterrence in state campaign finance laws and compares states that limit individual contributions to candidates with states that limit PAC contributions to candidates. 16 Where the rules push toward individual donations, he NDS candidates are more polarized. Where the rules open the hood gates to PAC money, the candidates are more moderate. Individual donors want to fall in love or express their hate. They're comfortable supporting candidates who OER less chance of victory but more affirmation of identity. Institutional donors are more pragmatic. They want candidates who will win, and they want candidates who, after they win, will get things done. This is less benign than it sounds. Institutional donors want government to work, it's true, but they want it to work in their favor. If individual donors give money as a form of identity expression, institutional donors give money as a form of investment. Individual donors are polarizing. Institutional donors are corrupting. American politics, thus, is responsive to two types of people, the polarized and the rich. In physics, there are deterrent rules at deterrent scales, stay with me. The quirks of quantum physics dominate the very small and the rules of special relativity describe the very large. So, too, with money in politics. In my experience, transactional giving drives the bills no one has heard of, the provisions few people read, the regulatory processes the public and the media tend to ignore. But at the macro level, the level of presidential politics and legislative ghts that lead front pages day after day, it's partisan dollars that dominate outcomes. If the business community could purchase its preferences in all things, immigration reform and infrastructure investment would have passed long ago and Jeb Bush would be president. Once an issue becomes a red-blue collision, corporate cash often loses out to the zero-sum logic of partisanship or the fury of the base. But that isn't to dismiss the power of access-based money. We don't hear about most of what politicians do, leaving a truly vast space for the corruptions of transactional fundraising to warp policy. And there are moments when the transactionalists and the polarizers settle into alliance with each other. That's often been the story of the Trump administration, which tweets about kneeling NFL players in the morning and passes corporate tax cuts in the evening. The Supreme Court, in a series of rulings dating back to the 70s, has decided that political spending is constitutionally protected speech, so you can't regulate it out of politics. But that means that the workable reforms tend to toss us between plans that amplify the powers of small donors, which worsen the problems of polarization, or plans that permit institutional money to aid the system, with all the attendant corruption. So long as politics runs on private donations, you're left with the inescapable problem that the people who donate want something different from the people who don't. The fall of the parties, the rise of the partisans. Donald Trump didn't win the Republican Party over gently. It was a hostile takeover. George W. Bush was a lousy president, he tweeted. As for John McCain, I like people who weren't captured, Trump said. He called Mitt Romney one of the dumbest and worst candidates in the history of Republican politics. It wasn't just Republican candidates Trump assailed. It was Republican policies. He promised to preserve Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, to raise taxes on people like himself. He was lying. He promised health care for everyone, also a lie, an end to free trade, a softer line on Russia, a wall across the border. Much of this polled well and drove support for Trump. But it also alienated large swaths of the GOP that either liked the people Trump was slandering, the ideological commitments he was betraying, or both. It was a strategy to mobilize an alienated minority of the Republican base in order to prevail in a crowded, fractured eld, and though it worked in the primary, everyone knew, or thought they knew, that a party divided against itself could not win a general election. Punditry was thick with predictions of a Republican wipeout, followed by an INTR party civil war. I think the GOP as a national party will have to be reconstituted, Matthew Dowd told Politico. There doesn't seem a good way to put this all together. 17 These predictions were based on an old understanding of politics, one in which partisanship was weaker and deviations in candidate choice were punished more severely. In 1964, Barry Goldwater ran hard to the right, and Republicans paid for it. Goldwater carried VE Deep South states and his home state of Arizona. He received 7 million fewer votes than Richard Nixon had gotten 4 years prior. And as historian Gio Ray Cavaservice points out in Rule and Ruin, the real carnage was further down the ticket. The party dropped 38 seats in the House, reducing Republican representation to its lowest level since the 1936 election. In the state legislatures, the party lost some 90 members of the upper houses and almost 450 members of the lower houses, again reducing Republican numbers to levels they had not touched since the Depression. Democrats faced a similar wipeout after shifting to the left in 1972. That year, George McGovern won the Democratic primary even though much of the Democratic Party viewed him with suspicion and even fear. Major Democratic interest groups, like the AFL-CIO, refused to endorse him in the general election, and top Democrats, including former governors of Florida, Texas, and Virginia, organized Democrats for Nixon. McGovern went on to lose with less than 40% of the vote, a dismal showing driven by Democrats who abandoned a nominee they considered unacceptable. None of this happened to Trump. And it's not because there weren't Republicans repulsed by his behavior or interest groups unnerved by his heterodoxies. It's because the parties are more polarized, so the alternative Hillary Clinton was unimaginable. This is the key to the weak parties/strong partisanship dichotomy. Threat is as powerful a political motivator as love. This was true among Trump's supporters in 2016. Exit polls showed that Clinton won 53% of voters who said their vote was motivated by strong support for the candidate they favored, but Trump had an 11-point margin among voters who said they were primarily voting against the other side. Trump's win, in other words, depended heavily on voters who were actually just voting against Clinton indeed. Some pre-election polls showed a majority of Trump supporters said they were motivated more by fear of Clinton than admiration of Trump. If you were a liberal, you didn't have to like Clinton to vote for her. Everything Trump did and said was evidence that the GOP had lost its mind and had to be kept from power at all costs. Much of Clinton's campaign proceeded in that frame. It was less about why she should be president than why he shouldn't be. But Clinton herself served that same purpose for conservatives. She is one of the most polarizing political figures of the modern era. She won her primary by running to Bernie Sanders's left on race and gender, and the entire Republican campaign was built around painting her as a criminal who deserved to be literally locked up if you leaned Republican, or simply found yourself uncomfortable with the browner coalition Democrats seemed to be building to win power. You didn't have to like Trump to vote against Clinton. This is true in Congress, too. In his 2019 paper Man Bites Blue Dog, Stephen Udick looked at congressional races and concluded that while moderates have historically enjoyed an advantage over ideologically extreme candidates, that gap has disappeared in recent years. 18 today, Udick found, moderates and ideologically extreme candidates are equally likely to be elected. As party affiliation becomes more important, individual candidate traits lose their power. You might prefer a moderate Republican to a rebreathing conservative, but given what the left looks like to you these days, you'll take either over a Democrat. I should say that there's dispute over this ending. In his book Who Wants to Run? How the Devaluing of Political Oaths Drives Polarization, Andrew Hall concluded that moderates still enjoy an advantage over more ideologically polarized candidates when they run, albeit a declining one. But the reason that Hall found moderates more electable is interesting. Nominating an extreme candidate drives up turnout among the other party negative partisanship, once again. What has changed, Hall and DS, is that moderates are increasingly disgusted by the political system, by the compromises and fundraising necessary to be a candidate, so fewer moderates are running in the RST place. It's an interesting debate, but I don't think it changes the fundamental story here. We're seeing less variation in voting patterns due to ideology and more stability due to partisanship. Which makes sense. When you vote for a candidate, you're not just voting for him or her. You are voting for, well, everything we have discussed up till now. You're voting for your side to beat the other side. You're voting to express your identity. You're voting for your members of Congress to be able to pass bills. You're voting for the judges your side would appoint. You're voting so those smug jerks you ght with in comment sections don't win, so that aunt or uncle you argue with at Thanksgiving can't lord it over you. You're voting to say your group is right and worthy and the other group is wrong and unworthy. That's bigger than any one candidate for president. It's true even if the personal characteristics of the other party's nominee leave your standard bearer looking like a decadent sleazebag. When you vote, you're voting to keep a candidate, a coalition, a movement, a media ecosystem, a set of donors, and a universe of people you don't like and maybe even fear out of power. All of that gives you reason to learn to like your candidate and, if you can't do that, to justify voting for him anyway. It's perfectly rational to care more about the party label than a candidate's character. Politics is about parties, not individuals. But look where that leaves us. Parties, and particularly the Republican Party, are losing control of whom they nominate. But once a party nominates someone, once it nominates anyone, that person is guaranteed the support of both the party's elites and its voters. Unlike in Goldwater's or McGovern's day, when ticket splitting was common, any candidate able to win his party's presidential primary can now count on his party's support and has a damn good chance of winning the presidency. Perhaps scarier, these dynamics gather even more force once a demagogic candidate has won the presidency. In January of 2016, the National Review, long the closest thing conservatism has had to a gatekeeper, published an issue entitled Against Trump. In it, the editors asked, if Trump were to become the president, the Republican nominee, or even a failed candidate with strong conservative support, what would that say about conservatives? The movement that ground down the Soviet Union and took the shine, at least temporarily, oh socialism would have fallen in behind a huckster. The movement concerned with such permanent things as constitutional government, marriage, and the right to life would have become a claque for a Twitter feed 19 in November 2019, as the House impeachment inquiry was proceeding. Rich Lowry, the editor of the National Review, explained to my Vox colleague Sean Illing how his views had evolved. Trump, he said, been steadfast on pro-life stew, on conscience rights, on judges. The downside, Lowry admitted, is he doesn't respect the separation of powers in our government, he doesn't think constitutionally, and says and does things no president should do or say. That seems like a pretty big downside. But, Lowry continued, at the end of the day, we're asked to either favor Trump or root for Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or Mayor Pete, who oppose us on basically everything. So it's a pretty simple calculation. 20. I've come to think of this as the central awe in our electoral software. In an era of high polarization, weak parties, and strong partisanship, it's easy to see how extremists and, more than that, demagogues penetrate the system. America was lucky, if that's the right word, that Trump proved himself, once in OCE, distractible, lazy, and uninterested in following through on his most authoritarian rhetoric. He's done plenty of damage, but he's not emerged as a dictator in control of American political institutions, as many liberals feared in the direct aftermath of the election. But the world also produces clever, disciplined demagogues. They are the ones who truly threaten republics, and they are watching. Chapter 8. When bipartisanship becomes irrational. On February 13, 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia died. Scalia was the pugnacious, literary anchor of the Supreme Court's 5-4 conservative majority. A brilliant writer, he was the rare judge whose prose attained a popular audience. In 2004, a book of his decisions, called Scalia Dissents, was published. What gained Scalia his public following wasn't merely his legal reasoning but his slashing style, the way he eyed his enemies, the ferocity with which he championed conservatism from the bench. Scalia was appointed to the Supreme Court by President Reagan in 1986 and unanimously confirmed by the Senate. Like many conservative theorists of the era, his jurisprudence was formed in the shadow of the Warren Court, which saw the Constitution as a living document that evolved alongside the country it founded. The Warren Court, and its successors, looked inside the Constitution and found protections that previous generations had missed, for African Americans, for women seeking abortions, for men who loved other men. Scalia thought this preposterous. The Constitution, he said, is not a living document. It's dead, dead, dead. One, he believed, or said he believed, in originalism. Two, the Constitution meant only what he understood it to have meant to the men who wrote it, at the time at which they wrote it. As such, while all sorts of protections might be read into the glittering language on the page, Scalia found them absent in the minds of the document's authors and thus absent from the law. Scalia was always a conservative, but he reveled in his status as a culture warrior as he aged. In 2013, he told New York Magazine that he had canceled his subscriptions to the Washington Post and the New York Times. It was the treatment of almost any conservative issue, he said. It was slanted and often nasty. And, you know, why should I get upset every morning? 3. He got his news, he admitted, from more congenial sources, the Washington Times, the Wall Street Journal, and right-wing talk radio hosts like Bill Bennett. Supreme Court justices are appointed for life. That means their retirements are typically planned. They step down when the time is right, when their friends and allies can name their replacement. But Scalia's unexpected passing threw all this into chaos. It deprived the court of both its most powerful conservative voice and its conservative majority, and it did so with a Democrat, President Obama, in the White House. But Obama's power over Scalia's replacement was not absolute. The Constitution gives the Senate advice and consent authority over judicial appointments, and in 2014 Republicans had won back the gavel. So Obama sought a conciliatory pick, Merrick Garland, the chief judge on the District of Columbia's Court of Appeals. Garland's name had come up before. In 2010, Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, a former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, had recommended Garland as a consensus nominee whose nomination could calm the bitter partisanship that had turned Supreme Court appointments into outright partisan warfare. "I have no doubts that Garland would get a lot of votes," Hatch said. "And I will do my best to help him get them for," but that was in 2010, when Democrats held the Senate. In 2016, with his own party in control, Hatch did not help Garland get the votes. Instead, Senate Republicans refused to take a vote on or even hold a hearing for Garland's nomination. The issue, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, was that it was an election year, and it would be absurd to lull a Supreme Court seat in an election year. "No, the choice properly belonged to whoever succeeded Obama, so the Senate wouldn't consider any nomination Obama made to Scalia's seat, no matter how qualified or moderate the candidate might be. This wasn't about Garland, it was about democracy. It was also unprecedented. There have been 103 prior cases in which, like the case of President Obama's nomination of Judge Garland, an elected president has faced an actual vacancy on the Supreme Court and began an appointment process prior to the election of a successor," wrote law professors Robin Bradley Carr and Jason Mazzone. "In all 103 cases, the president was able to both nominate and appoint a replacement justice, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. This is true even of all 8 such cases where the nomination process began during an election year. 5. McConnell's bet paid off. Trump won the 2016 election. Indeed, there's a reasonable argument that conservative mobilization around the vacancy was what pushed Trump over the finish line, and conservative jurist Neil Gorsuch was named to the open seat, preserving the GOP's 5-4 majority. "One of my proudest moments was when I looked Barack Obama in the eye and I said, 'Mr. President, you will not lull the Supreme Court vacancy,'" McConnell said. 6. The Garland affair remains an open wound to liberals, an example of how Republicans will stop at nothing to gain and retain power. "I'm the longest-serving senator. I've never seen anything like that with either the Republicans or the Democrats," said Patrick Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont. "We all take an oath to uphold the Constitution. The Constitution says the president shall nominate, says we shall advise and consent. The president followed the Constitution. The Senate violated it." 7. McConnell, for his part, gave up the game in 2019. Speaking at a Chamber of Commerce luncheon in Kentucky, he was asked what he'd do if a Supreme Court vacancy opened in 2020, the year of the next presidential election. CNN's Ted Barrett reported what happened next. The leader took a long sip of what appeared to be iced tea before announcing with a smile, "Oh, we'd lull it," triggering loud laughter from the audience. 8. There was no mystery to McConnell's reasoning, but he laid it bare anyway. The simplest way for politicians to have a long-lasting positive impact was to appoint judges. "Everything else changes," McConnell said, "but judges serve for life." The hard question isn't why McConnell blocked the Garland nomination. It's why anyone ever expected him or anyone else to do anything different. America's unstable form of government. The most powerful critique of America's political system was published in 1990 by a Spanish political sociologist named Juan Linz. Linz was an outsider to American politics and, more important, to its self-serving mythologies. Born in the Weimar Republic in 1927 and raised in Spain under the Francoist dictatorship, Linz both lived through and studied the circumstances in which political systems fail. The causes of collapse were often encoded in the architecture of the government. He showed that systems based around an independent president tended to dissolve, as conflicts between the executive and the legislature were often irresolvable, and irresolvable conflicts end in crisis and collapse. But America's political system posed a puzzle for Linz. As an outside observer, he was free from the quasi-religious reverence we award our founding documents. He knew that the American political system had failed wherever else it had been tried. He knew that America itself was loath to impose its system on other nations. For all our nation-building adventurism, we never give any country developing into a democracy a system that works like ours. But he also knew that in America, the American political system had worked. In 1990, in a paper entitled "The Perils of Presidentialism," Linz explained why. The vast majority of the stable democracies in the world were parliamentary regimes, where whoever wins legislative power also wins executive power. 9. America, however, was a presidential democracy. The president is elected separately from the Congress and can often be at odds with it. This system had been tried before. America, worryingly, was the only place where it had survived. The problem is straightforward. In parliamentary systems, the prime minister is the leader of the coalition that controls the legislature. If that coalition loses an election, it loses power. But at any given moment, only one party or coalition holds power. In presidential systems, by contrast, one party can control the legislature and another can control the presidency. Both parties, then, have a claim to democratic legitimacy. Under such circumstances, asked Linz, who has the stronger claim to speak on behalf of the people, the president or the legislative majority that opposes his policies? It gets worse. What happens when the majorities that the president and the Congress represent are de-rent majorities, who voted at de-rent times and through de-rent methods? Linz noted that presidents tend to be elected by voters but legislatures tend to re-ect geography, with small towns and rural areas given outsized power. It's hard enough resolving a democratic disagreement that plays out among a single electorate. What do you do when you are facing a disagreement that re-ects de-rent kinds of electorates? It's a question with no answer. In general, we assume a system like this encourages compromise, and that's true, when the competing political coalitions are open to compromise. But a system like this can also encourage crises where, in other countries, the armed forces were often tempted to intervene as a mediating power. 10. This is why there are no long-standing presidential democracies save for the United States. And it's why America doesn't impose its specie form of government on others. Think about Germany, Japan, Italy, and Austria, wrote Vox's Matt Iglesias. These are countries that were defeated by American military forces during the Second World War and given constitutions written by local leaders operating in close collaboration with occupation authorities. It's striking that even though the U.S. Constitution is treated as a sacred text in America's political culture, we did not push any of these countries to adopt our basic framework of government. 11. Linz admitted that he couldn't fully answer the question of why America was de-rent. He suspected that the uniquely de-jus character of American political parties, which, ironically, exasperates many American political scientists and leads them to call for responsible, ideologically disciplined parties, has something to do with it. Whatever the explanation, Linz continued, the American case seems to be an exception. The development of modern political parties, particularly in socially and ideologically polarized countries, generally exacerbates, rather than moderates, conflicts between the legislative and the executive. 12. Linz was writing in 1990, when America's political parties were far more exceptional, far more mixed and moderated, than they are today. But what read in 1990 like an explanation of what made America's political system de-rent now reads like an analysis of why America's system is in crisis. The Garland era is a perfect example. For all the fury over McConnell's behavior, what, exactly, did he do wrong? In the 2014 election, Republicans took control of the Senate with a decisive 4-vote majority. True, the 2014 election had the lowest turnout in 70 years, and sure, only a third of Senate seats are up for election in any given year, and yes, the Senate is a noxiously undemocratic institution that gives a voter in Wyoming 66 times as much power as a voter in California, but the rules are what they are. McConnell was leader of a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. He had the votes to block any nominations Obama might make. Why shouldn't he have used them? Did the voters who gave him that majority really want him to let Obama replace Scalia with a Democratic justice, no matter how moderate? Wouldn't it have been more of a betrayal of his voters if he'd led a new Republican majority in the Senate to help Obama IP the Supreme Court to a 5-4 liberal split? You can argue, as many did, that Obama represented a more legitimate Democratic majority. He won a national election, with much higher voter turnout, in 2012. He was President of the United States of America. He had nominated a clearly qualified candidate, in accordance with the historical norm. McConnell's behavior was both unprecedented and dangerous, in Attlee refusing to consider any candidates nominated by a president of the other party. McConnell established a principle that could destroy the Supreme Court. Given the Senate's small state bias, it's easy enough to imagine extended periods of divided control, and given McConnell's successful deployment of absolute obstruction, it's easy enough to imagine vacancies on the court going continuously unfilled. But why is that McConnell's problem? Why should he have been the one to fold? Perhaps Obama should have bowed to the winners of the most recent election and nominated a Scalia-esque conservative to LL Scalia's seat. It may sound ridiculous, but both McConnell and Obama represented legitimate electoral majorities, and there was no obvious way to resolve their differences. Ideological differences are easier to resolve when they are smaller. That's why Linz put the uniquely diffuse character of American political parties at the center of America's unusual political success. In the 20th century, the ideological and demographic diversity of the Republican and Democratic coalitions lowered the stakes of partisan political disagreement considerably. Our core cleavages played out within the two parties rather than just between them. But those days are gone. McConnell's obstructive innovations are a cause of our current divisions, but they are also a consequence of them. The question that Supreme Court vacancies pose in the modern era is different from the question they posed in previous eras. That's because a more polarized political system has led to a more polarized Supreme Court, which, as with the Garland case, is further polarizing the political system. Remember, everything is a feedback loop. In an analysis published after Justice Anthony Kennedy retired, law professors Lee Epstein and Eric Posner wrote in the New York Times that in the 50s and 60s, the ideological biases of Republican appointees and Democratic appointees were relatively modest. 13 Even as late as the 90s, justices regularly voted in ideologically unpredictable ways. In the 1991 term, for instance, Byron White, a Democratic appointee, voted more conservatively than all but two of the Republican appointees, Antonin Scalia and William Rehnquist. But that's changed. Over the past decade, justices have hardly ever voted against the ideology of the president who appointed them, Epstein and Posner ND. Only Justice Kennedy, named to the court by Ronald Reagan, did so with any regularity. Their chart is striking. The Supreme Court is a powerful institution in American life, and it has often been a controversial institution in American life, but it has not always been a politically polarized institution in American life. As the parties have become more ideological, however, their expectations for Supreme Court justices followed suit. It's easy to read an analysis like this and think the authors are describing a golden age. But it's all a matter of perspective. The eras of relative moderation are considered eras of failure and betrayal by the political parties responsible for them. Republicans lament the heterodoxies of justices like Earl Warren, John Paul Stevens, David Souter, and Anthony Kennedy. Indeed, it's precisely in response to these unpredictable appointments that the parties began to develop more ideological and reliable methods of sourcing judges. Scalia was one of those more ideological justices, and he made the case for his approach explicitly. "It really enrages me to hear people refer to it as a politicized court," he said in 2012. "Maybe the legislature and the president are not as stupid as you think. They assuredly picked those people because of who they are, and when they get to the court they remain who they were." 14 In this telling, the point of the nomination process is to ND a candidate who will vote in concert with the expectations of his sponsors. Future divergence isn't a feature of independent thinking but a awe in vetting. Today, candidates considered for Supreme Court vacancies have a vanishingly small chance of surprising their sponsors in the future. The path to being nominated to the court runs through decades of ideological and professional party service. Kennedy's ultimate replacement, Brett Kavanaugh, was a top STAER in the George W. Bush administration in addition to being a member of the conservative legal group the Federalist Society. It's not just that more ideologically reliable candidates raise the stakes around Supreme Court nominations. Deeper political divides are leading to more partisan cases. Consider the right's multi-year effort to convince the court to destroy Obamacare, a campaign with no corollary in the aftermath of, say, Medicare's or Medicaid's passage. Partisan disagreement and paralysis in Congress are making the court's judgments more consequential, as when the court throws out a bill or invalidates a program, legislators rarely have the bipartisan consensus or partisan power to revisit the legislation and